It's just about 3 o'clock. This is KTOO-FM in Juneau. I'm Lori Scandling, and I'll be pleased to join you in just a few minutes on Juneau Afternoon, where we'll get details about Perseverance Theater's Summerfest. We'll talk with Joanne and Dave Lesh over at the Gustavus Inn, and we'll continue our Fish 101 series as we discuss fly fishing with Brad Elfers. Mary Fitzgerald and Jana Brewster will be here to highlight the Front Street Community Health Center. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music and more. That's today, right after National Native News. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, a flash mob held a demonstration recently in front of an energy company's open house in British Columbia. The protest, which included First Nations, was against plans for a liquefied natural gas plant. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
It's the latest protest against the plant proposed by TransCanada. The British Columbia Oil and Gas Commission has granted legal permits to TransCanada to undertake exploratory drilling. TransCanada also wants to build two massive natural gas pipelines to liquefied natural gas terminals planned for the northwest coast, totaling $9 billion. And it's only part of what the energy company hopes to do. But many people in the region, including First Nations, fear the huge push for pipelines and LNG plants and fracking for gas will poison the northern watershed. Many of the protesters were from the Gitxsan First Nation. One of them was Chris Timms.
We started seeing speeches of the different people that were involved of what LNG development meant to them. And so we did it with Enbridge, and we also wanted to make sure that LNG was not forgotten about, that LNG was also at the forefront of the issues that Enbridge also has.
Protesters also fear the impact on wild salmon. They also say the people who live in the region are about the air, the land, and the water. And when those are being taken away, it will destroy what they have and have had for many years. They also say they will stop the project. Current plans by the industry could lead to more fracking along the pipeline routes. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Reservations lag behind the rest of the country in access to the Internet. Native business leaders are in Washington, D.C. this week. And as Matt Laszlo reports, broadband is one of the issues being discussed.
Tribal members have come from as far away as Alaska to attend the Reservation Economic Summit. Joining them are U.S. government officials who say they want to invest in Indian country. Derek Watchman is a member of the Navajo Nation. He's also chairman of the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development, which organized the summit. Watchman says access to the Internet remains a major issue on reservations.
I know that back at Navajo, it takes, you know, a couple million dollars to do a mile of electricity line and telecommunications. So because of the sparseness of where folks are located, it's a challenge to invest in infrastructure, but it is needed.
Jeff Blackwell is the chief of the Native Affairs Office at the Federal Communications Commission. He says Native Americans can overcome barriers to Internet access by making broadband in schools and libraries a priority.
One of the questions in our tribal government engagement, where we want to get carriers talking to the tribal governments, the governments that represent the people they're serving, is to talk about service to core anchor community institutions.
The FCC says 6% of Americans lacking broadband are on reservations. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Earthworks at a Louisiana state park were designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site this week. The listing will help protect and preserve Poverty Point. Located in Louisiana's lower Mississippi Valley, the park includes mounds and ridges built by indigenous people. Poverty Point will join other sites on the list, like the Grand Canyon. The United South and Eastern Tribes Organization supported the site's nomination. On this day in 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the case Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl, known as Baby Veronica. The court examined a custody dispute between the biological father, Dustin Brown, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, and a South Carolina couple, which the girl's mother chose for a planned adoption. The High Court sent the case back to lower courts to decide Veronica's placement. The Indian Child Welfare Act, intended to keep Native families together, was used in the case. Tribes, advocates, and Native organizations closely followed proceedings, raising concerns about potential impacts in Indian country. The girl was eventually handed over to the couple, Matt and Melanie Capobianco, and Brown dropped the legal fight. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
The thought of my sons growing up without me inspired me to quit smoking.
I talked to my doctors, and then I threw away all my cigarettes, ashtrays, and lighters.
I started exercising instead of smoking.
Staying away from alcohol when I was first quitting was key.
I kept on trying. Learn something each time.
Do whatever it takes.
No matter how many times it takes.
We did it. So can you.
You can quit. We can help. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Good afternoon. I'm Laurie Scandling, and this is Juno Afternoon, and Jeff Brown is on the board. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. I actually just looked up a moment ago at the weather, and I see the word clear there amidst words like clouds, showers. So decreasing clouds, a few showers tonight, but it looks like it'll be mostly clear tomorrow, highs around 66. So good weather news ahead. This afternoon, our first guests are Dave Hunsaker and Carolyn Howarth. They are two of three directors who are involved in a unique, what they're calling, Summerfest for Perseverance Theater. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Lori.
So the concept is that there will be three plays rotating at various showtimes across the street from our studios over at the Juno Arts and Humanities Center at the Jack,
beginning
this weekend. So talk to me a little bit about why a summer repertory, when that hasn't happened in virtually all of Perseverance's 30-plus years I can think of.
Well, because it never has happened in all of the 30-plus years we can think. It's a new thing that Perseverance wanted to try. I think there was a special grant to try to explore the idea, and the idea of doing something for three shows running at once in a kind of repertory is a new thing. We'll see how it goes.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
There will be shows every day of the week, except, I think, was it Thursday it'll be dark?
No.
Even Thursday?
Yes, pretty much all the time. There will be one day a week, I think, that there aren't any shows. But there are such a variety of show times. Sometimes they're at 11, 2, 6 p.m., and there are three different plays, so it gives people a really wide opportunity of genre. One is a comedy. The other two are more Alaskan stories, and I think it's kind of across the board, drama, dance, comedy, gives something for everybody.
Carolyn, yours is the comedy.
Mine is.
Why don't you describe the play and your work as a director on it?
Sure. Well, the name of the play is Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. It's written by Christopher Durang, and it won the Tony Award in 2013. It's kind of a mashup of Christopher Durang, who is zany and absurd, and Anton Chekhov, who was a Russian playwright around the last turn of the century. So it's a family drama, basically, with lots and lots of comedy about this crazy family in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And my job has been to guide these actors through finding the heart of the play and the pathos as well as the comedy. And I think we've come up with a really good product. I have six fabulous actors, three of whom are very well known on the Juno stages. Katie Jensen is in it, Patricia Hall, and Ben Brown. And they play the three family members and are doing just a fabulous job. And we're having so much fun in rehearsal. I really hope people enjoy it. I think they will.
Dave, you're doing one of the two Alaska-themed plays. I know one of the plays is Blue Bear, which Perseverance mounted, 3 years ago?
I think so.
The Lynn
Schooler
production, which was a beautiful play.
Yeah.
Very touching. It was just a lovely piece. Talk about your play. You've generated this play.
Right.
Describe it.
It's called Warriors, and it's basically it's about Alaska Native soldiers. And primarily it's set in 1943 around the Battle of Attu, prior to the Battle of Attu and the Aleutians, and two of the characters are members of the sort of legendary Kastner's Cutthroats, who are part of the Army Intelligence, but who are mostly Native people, outdoors people, and they were kind of like a version of a World War II version of the Navy SEALs, but exclusive to Alaska. They would carry their own weapons if they wanted to. They didn't wear uniforms, and they were a pretty intrepid bunch, and they were mostly Natives. So that's one of the stories. The other story is set in Baghdad in 2003, and there are two women soldiers in that one who are both Alaska Natives also, who find themselves in that. So there's along the way, there's a lot of ideas that we can explore, one being that there are an inordinate number demographically of Alaska Native people in the armed forces. So we kind of look at why. Not sure we answer why, but we look at it. We ask it. The issue of when one fights to defend one's own country, which they were literally doing here in Alaska, of course, after the Japanese invasion in World War II, and what it's like to be part of an invading force in somebody else's country. So
the two women, are they based on someone you know, or are they based on records you've read, or did you create that out of your imagination?
They're fictitious, but I've been interviewing lots and lots of vets, Native vets, from all the wars I could find. Way back to many years ago, I interviewed a bunch of Aleut people, some of the ones who had been imprisoned in Japan during the war, the ones from Attu, and then a bunch of them who were in the Battle of Attu and the landing at Kiska. And then, vets in every other conflict since. And so, yeah, the women characters are based on roughly on people I know, but they're sort of composites.
Sure.
Same with the guys in Kastner's Cutthroats.
Okay. So you mentioned that a number of issues are raised through the exploration of your approach of a then and a now.
Right.
And, of course, that's the purpose of art, is to help us think about who we are in the larger world and get us a little bit, I call it the cognitive dissonance, let's think about this. Will there be any before or after conversations with the audience on any of the productions?
I haven't heard talk about that. There should be, though. That would be a good thing.
Either. I don't know, but that's actually a really good idea. There's something that we should talk about with our production teams.
Because art stimulates, or should.
Yeah.
Yeah, so absolutely. And I know people like to talk about what they see often. And so that's an excellent idea. I will bring that up.
So in thinking about daytime performances, my first thought was, you must be thinking tourists will come see this. And it's not a cabaret or one of our, Gold Rush, Can-Can Girls kind of thing. Are you marketing this to folks who are walking around during the day visiting our city, say, off of a cruise ship?
Yes, certainly. Frankly, I think we're marketing to everyone. I mean, there's a lot here in this festival for locals and tourists alike. And I think that tourists in particular are going to find some stories that they wouldn't normally see in the lower 48. And with the case of Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, it might very well appeal to a local who perhaps feels like they've seen or read the Alaska stories. Who knows? But Dave's play in particular is brand new.
It's the
premiere. They're going to want to check that out too. What's exciting about it is that there's something for everyone.
Now, this is called a festival. Does that mean it's a short period of time, or will the repertory run all summer?
It will run all summer. We open on June 28th, which is this coming Saturday, and we close on August 6th.
So approximately
five weeks.
So if people want to see it, they need to pay attention to the schedule. And we've mentioned that there will be a performance, at least one, almost every day, but that the times vary. So what's the best place for someone to look to find a time of a particular play or to see what the entire schedule is? Do you have a website?
Probably on the Perseverance website, which is Perseverance Theater, with R-E, .org.
People need to remember how to spell Perseverance and then Theatry.
Perseverance.org.
Yeah.
Right. Or the number they can call to get information is 463 TIX, T-I-X-S, or 8497.
And tickets can be bought online. I know I have done that. So you can see all the shows, one show. I'm thinking right now of family members who are coming, and I think this would be wonderful, particularly on days that are a little bit damp, maybe. For us, that matters. For tourists, as we were saying, going inside on a warm day is absolutely okay. I'm really excited to know that we have an art selection like this during the summer months, because this is new. Very nice.
Right. And right downtown, which I think is also super exciting.
It is.
Something that Juneau people will be interested in is how much the Jack has been transformed for this. Essentially, a theater has been built inside it with raised seating for the audiences, a whole stage, a light grid. It's completely transformed.
So I didn't think to ask this, but with three different productions, is there a constant turnover, or do you have three separate areas with the... I know Blueberry is a very simple set, as I recall. How I guess you have a logistics person for that, but how is that going to work?
Well, it's three very different sets, all on the same stage. So between performances, a changeover crew comes in, completely takes down one set and puts up the other, sometimes in the space of 45 minutes.
It's impressive.
It's very impressive.
You must have, truly, you must have a very amazing, competent, dedicated crew behind what the audience will see.
Absolutely. And they've been working so hard, and they're very good at their jobs. And rarely get the applause because they're not out in front where people see them.
Sure. And when they do their job well, invisible.
It's invisible.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. We're talking with Carolyn Howarth and Dave Hunsicker about the Perseverance Theater Summerfest, which really is a repertory of three plays that will run for about 5 weeks at various times, almost every day of the week, beginning this Saturday, June 28th, through August 6th at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center across the street. And you can find out more information at Perseverance Theater, and theater ends in TRE.org. So check out Blue Bear, Warriors, and I don't know if I can remember, Masha, Sasha.
It's tough.
Let's see, Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike.
There you go.
I think we could make a cheer out of that, and I'd remember it. But this looks exciting, and check online for times and which shows are on. It'd be a wonderful opportunity to take your friends and family and for local people to see themselves. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lori.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 25th of June, 2014. It was on this day, 1947, Anne Frank's diary was published, a diary she had begun keeping in 1942 when she was 13. She wrote it during the 2 years that her family was in hiding in Amsterdam from the Nazis. They were discovered in 1944, taken to concentration camps, where Anne died of typhus in 1945. Her father's secretary, Meep Gies, found the diary, gave it to Mr. Frank after the war. He published it after removing things he felt were too personal. The English version came out in 1952, and in 1995, an unexpurgated edition. Anne Frank, who wrote, "It's an odd idea for someone like me to keep a diary, not only because I have never done so before, but because it seems to me that neither I, nor for that matter anyone else, will be interested in the unbosomings of a 13-year-old schoolgirl. Still, what does that matter? I want to write, but more than that, I want to bring out all kinds of things that lie buried deep in my heart." It was on this day, 1942, Dwight D. Eisenhower became the commander of the U.S. troops in Europe. He'd been in the military for more than 20 years, but he'd never seen combat. All he'd ever done was train soldiers. It's the birthday of George Orwell, born Eric Blair in a small village in Bengal, India, in 1903, who went on to write Animal Farm and 1984. George Orwell, who said, "The great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there is a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms, like a cuttlefish squirting out ink." And it was on this day in 1950 the Korean War began, when North Korean soldiers invaded the South. They crossed the 38th parallel and marched into Seoul, and America geared up for war. It was really the beginning of the Cold War. Mao Zedong sent Chinese troops to the aid of the North. In 1953, a ceasefire agreement was signed. After 5 million people, about half of them civilians, either died, were wounded, or disappeared as a result of the conflict. Here's a poem for today by Andrew Marvel, Thoughts in a Garden. What wondrous life is this I lead? Ripe apples drop about my head, the luscious clusters of the vine upon my mouth do crush their wine. The nectarine and curious peach into my hands themselves do reach, stumbling on melons as I pass, and snared with flowers I fall on grass. Meanwhile the mind from pleasure less withdraws into its happiness, the mind, that ocean where each kind does straight its own resemblance find. Yet it creates, transcending these, far other worlds and other seas, annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shade. Andrew Marvel's poem, Thoughts in a Garden. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith and produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Your calendars for 6 p.m. July 26th. Cuplinks and Pearls is back. Join Ha'ani at the Jordan Creek Center for a night filled with casino games, live music, an international buffet, and more. Details at 586-9251. Brought to you by Ha'ani.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Robert Scandlin, and I'm happy to say that we are helping Gustavus celebrate its 100th anniversary. And we will have Joanne and Dave Lesh on the phone right now. They are longtime owners of the Gustavus Inn. And if you have not stayed at this beautiful homestead and seen the fantastic garden over there, you are missing a truly quintessential Alaska experience. So who's on the phone, Dave or Joanne?
Well, we're both sharing a phone here.
Oh, wonderful. So glad to have you on the show. And I was sharing with Jeff that I was just over visiting you folks and how much I enjoyed it. So what's being harvested over at the Gustavus Inn this week? What are you serving at lunch and dinner and breakfast?
Well, right now we have a surplus of bok choy and the chard and kale. And the lettuce is coming on big time now. So we're harvesting. All the salads are straight from the garden. And basil from the greenhouse, lots of pesto, flatbread pesto for hors d'oeuvres. And
the strawberries are ripe down on the beach, too.
Oh, those Gustavus strawberries, sweet as can be. That's exciting. And what kind of fish is on the table right now?
Dave just pulled our pot. We've got Dungeness crab from Frederick Sound, or from over by Hoona, Port Frederick, and we're having that for dinner tonight. But king salmon, we had some white king salmon come to the dock a couple of days ago.
So why don't the two of you talk a little bit about the history of the Gustavus Inn and about the Lesh family. I know the two of you have been on board there, I'm guessing 35 years, because I probably first came over there and got to know you there about 35 years ago. But let's talk about how the Gustavus Inn came to be.
Well, my parents came out in 61, and I don't think it's true, but I always say that they're probably the first tourists that came to Gustavus, because they actually stayed at the Riverside Lodge, which was run by the Kalviks then, and with nothing to do. They weren't here to work, or which is what most of the guests then were doing, were working. It wasn't any tourism in Gustavus. And they had, when they first moved to Alaska in 60, they had wanted to homestead in a place like Gustavus. When they discovered it was right across the way from Juneau, they came out to look at it. And the next summer we camped in 62, I think it was, and then for two weeks along the river. And then in 60, whatever, the next year, we got an old floating log home on logs and towed it up Salmon River and squatted on one of the original homesteaders' land. And then in the winter of 65, the Kalviks wanted to sell, and Mom and Dad bought it. And the crew that was building Glacier Bay Lodge was staying at the inn, and so we had a built-in clientele right away. And the summer of 66 was the first summer that tourists came through Gustavus, and they started the day cruise up Glacier Bay. And we started, hosting tourists. And then we also did a lot of, over the next 10 years, a lot of crews when they're rebuilding the lodge and working on the airport stuff. There wasn't any place to stay out here except for the inn. So we had those years, and my sister Sal and Tom McLaughlin had it for 4 years. My mom and dad had it for 10 years, and then Sal and Tom ran it for 4 years. And then this is our 35th, so that makes next year our 50th anniversary.
I was going to say we're coming up on the 50th anniversary. Congratulations on that. Dave, you mentioned that your parents were some of the first tourists. Why were people originally in Gustavus? I know that there's a long runway over there. Was there a World War II strategic importance of Gustavus, or what brought folks to that area initially? Do you know?
Well, the airport came second. The initial residents here were hoping to farm, and it was just a bunch of flat land, and they were Midwesterners, and I guess they weren't very successful fishermen, so they wanted to farm here. And Jim McCoviak's book is all about the original years here, and basically that was why the first settlers first came here. Now the airport was built as a series of airports along the Pacific Rim, servicing the war effort out in the Aleutians. And so Yakutat and Cape Yakutaga, Cordova, all down the Aleutian, King Salmon. This is just one of them. There was a big flat area here with relatively easy to build the airport, so they did. And there was also a POW camp over at Excursion Inlet, which was later turned into the cannery. So that's why we got this big airport. Until just several years ago, it was the longest runway in Southeast, and still the only one with a crosswind runway.
And, of course, now the Alaska Marine Highway System makes regular visits to Gustavus, making it very, very accessible for those passengers who want to walk on or bring a bike or just come over for an evening or two. So, Joanne, you have been associated with the lodge for a long time. What would you say have been the biggest changes that you have seen in those decades as you have helped run and work at the Gustavus Inn?
Well, when we moved out here, essentially you had to have a man because you had to crank up that big generator to generate your own power. And, of course, we all have our own water systems right now, too. But since we moved here in 1980, we have gotten our hydroelectric power. We've gotten phones. We've gotten a paved road. The post office used to be kind of a contract situation in our driveway here at the inn. The inn, originally when Sally had it, she was the weather station, the Alaska Airlines counter, the radio telephone, and the phone for the whole community, and we had freezers for every person in our garage because we were the only 24-hour power. And we had to get our own fuel by oil drums across the dock from Huna, and it was just a lot of um, individual effort, still the homesteading frontier out here. So now we have the modern conveniences, and we even have a little grocery store and hardware store here and three coffee shops. So
I had the opportunity to meet your son, who was the chef the night recently when we stayed over. Are you two getting prepared to shift the management of the inn to the next generation, or are you on board for many, many more summers?
Well, we are getting ready to put the inn up for sale. It may go to our son, but we're just going to put it out there for people to contact us if they're interested. We have a good plan in place right now. We're just going along doing what we've done for 35 years and looking forward to our 50th year next year.
Well, it's a milestone for sure. And for folks who are listening, if they don't know, the Gustavus Inn a couple of years ago won the Baird Foundation Award for having exceptional food, which, of course, the idea of farm-to-table could bring a smile to your face when you show up at the Gustavus Inn, because the farm is the front yard. There has been really no other concept but farm-to-table at the Gustavus Inn. And the Baird Foundation Award is something you don't put yourself up for that. It is secretly nominated, and that was an award that was a well-deserved. What changes do you see happening at the Gustavus Inn, say, in the next a few years as you round that 50th year marker?
Wow, I don't know. We've been hosting people the exact same way since 1965. Essentially, you are our house guests, and we're going to make sure everything's done for you. I don't see that changing while Dave and I are still running the inn, because that's what we like to do, and we'll leave it to the next generation to make changes. So we're going to keep serving the same dinners and three meals a day and hosting our guests and making sure they get a chance to see Icy Strait and Glacier Bay National Park.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to know each of you over the years and to spend some time at the inn. And I love the family meals. It's a way to meet others from elsewhere who have quickly developed a deep appreciation for the Gustavus area, for your family, and for the inn. So thanks to both Dave and Joanne Lesh for talking with us today about the Gustavus Inn, which is coming up on its 50th year anniversary. And happy anniversary to Gustavus as it celebrates a century. I wish you well for the remainder of the summer. Lots of sunshine. Hope it's coming your way.
Well, thank you. You know, we're having our big homesteader weekend this weekend, and no one has really gotten the schedule out, but lots of things going on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Oh,
pancake feed on Saturday, Sunday morning, and all-day festivities on Saturday. We have dignitaries out, and it's going to be really fun.
Would there be some information online somewhere if someone wanted to look at more? What could you tell us about that?
The Gustavus Historical Archives and Antiquities. It's under gustavushistory.org, and there's a schedule.
That's exciting. Well, have fun, and best wishes to you both.
Thank you, Lori.
Bye-bye. Bye.
I mean it must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in, but it's all right. That is, I think it's not too bad. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever.
We continue on our Juno afternoon journey this afternoon. My name is Lori Scandling, and on the board is Jeff Brown today. We are have the opportunity to talk right now with Brad Elfers, who is our guest as part of this summer's series called Fish 101. And our topic this afternoon is fly fishing. Welcome, Brad. Glad to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
So we were visiting a little bit before we went on, and I said, can you really make a living running a shop that is tailored to fly fishers? And I'm curious about that. I mean, I suppose you can sell a few flies and a few rods, but talk about how you got into that business and how you've made a go of that.
Sure, yeah, and that was a lot of people asked that question when I started the job, including my parents. So, but yeah, I started it actually 16 years ago. So far, I'm still able to make a living. But yeah, I started off as a fly fishing guide here in Juneau. Doing fly-out trips, taking folks from the cruise ships out on half-day little excursions to go fishing. And one thing just kind of led to another, and it seemed like there are a lot of people in Juneau who were interested in fly fishing, but it's a little bit hard to get started or learn how to do it without some kind of knowledgeable help. And so I started the shop, and one thing led to another, and we've grown over the years, and here I am today.
Where's the shop, Brad?
It actually recently, we just moved about 2 months ago. For the first 16 years, we were downtown and had a really good time there. But we've grown and kind of outgrew our spot downtown, and we're now out on Old Dairy Road, kind of right next to Urgent Care there. So we're a little closer to the airport and have a little more elbow room out there to do what we need to do.
Now, are charters still part of your business?
You know, there is. We book trips for the local outfitter, so that they're a separate company from us that does the fly-out trips. And we don't guide out of the shop anymore. There's just not enough hours in the day to get everything done. So, yeah, we leave the guiding to those guys, and we do more of the retail and classes and instruction and all that kind of stuff.
Talk to me about the retail products. What's most in demand? Is it a custom rod? Is it a selection of very special flies? Is it how to make either of those?
Yeah, you know, probably the most in demand here in the summer is the flies. I mean, everybody wants the flies, and they're always evolving. They're always changing. People who tie flies are very inventive and are always looking for a new twist or a new way to do it to make a fly that's a little more effective. And so that's always going on, and that's fun. So people want to know what the hot fly is for, you know, whatever's fishing right now. You know, right now there's a sockeye fishery up Windfall Creek that's just about
every
to close.
Wednesday, is that right?
Yeah, Wednesdays and Saturdays,
yeah.
But just through the month of June. So it's, you know, today and this Saturday, and it's over. So people want the hot fly for that, because, you know, if you're going to walk that far, you
what
don't want to have
the
it.
What is the hot fly?
Oh, gosh, there's two or three, but we have different little ones that we've invented, ones like called the sockeye lantern that year after year seems to catch a lot of fish.
Why?
And yeah, I don't
what,
know.
What material is on it that makes it irresistible?
Well, it's hard to say, but it's a little green, teeny fly. It's only probably half an inch long, and it's got just the right amount of sparkle, I guess, that seems to make them want to grab it. But if you threw one in there that was blue, I don't think you'd probably catch a fish all day.
Did you create that one, Brad?
You know, it was one that basically kind of it was a group effort, I would say, in the shop, where we kept getting feedback, and you try it with this, with that, you mix it up, and then you finally hit on what consistently works. So.
Now, do you produce the flies? Would you produce, say, a batch of the sockeye fly, and then you have them on display, or do you take orders? How does that work? And are you the creator, then, of them in terms of doing the craftspersonship?
You know, there are several people in town that do this, too, that is kind of a sidelight, is they kind of create flies. And they're incredibly inventive, and they're coming up with new ones. And what they'll do is they'll take that fly to a company that's probably not in Alaska, that's in Colorado, or there's one in California. And they will actually have the fly produced because they can tie flies at a rapid rate. It's one of those things that's very hard to do on your own and make any kind of a living. Or we find that some of our popular like pink salmon flies, you know, we might go through like over 1,000 of them in the summer. And I used to tie them, and I couldn't do it anymore.
Your fingers can't keep up?
It's just too much, yeah.
Yeah. So. What about rods? Do you have a lot of specialty orders for particular types of rods for the fly fishing?
You know, I wouldn't call them like special orders, but they're certainly particular rod sizes that work in Alaska that are suited for salmon fishing.
A larger fish, I would guess.
A larger fish, exactly. Mm-hmm. Most people think of fly fishing and they think of trout. And that's certainly a big part of the game here. But, you know, we're chasing king salmon around and sockeye and all these things, too. So a little different, bigger rod. We don't build them ourselves, mostly because we can't do as good a job as some of the factories down in Washington and Oregon do. So,
what are the most common materials used to build effective fly rods? I think of bamboo. Is that way old-fashioned?
That's way old-fashioned.
Okay.
Yeah. But that was state-of-the-art. But then sometime in the 1950s, kind of through the miracle of chemistry age, they came out with fiberglass rods, which were much more durable. You know, bamboo being a natural fiber, really, it was easier to break, or if you didn't take care of it, it would warp. And then fiberglass rolled over into graphite in the early 80s, and that's been the progression, and now it's just more and more specialized graphite rods. And the big difference is they're just way easier to cast than those old bamboo rods. I think a lot of people used to get into fly fishing or give it a try, but they just you'd hear them say, you know, I couldn't get the hang of it. Those rods were so hard to use that, to use an analogy, it might be like when people used to ski on those big old wooden skis in leather boots. I mean, it had to be incredibly difficult compared to what technology is out there today. So,
talk to me about the kind of skill or talent, maybe that's an overstatement, that is necessary to be successful as a fly fisher person.
Well, we're very lucky in Alaska because we have a lot of fish to catch. So that helps a lot, because when you first get started, I mean, I think people have a great time fly fishing from the first minute they start. It's just fun. It's fun to cast. But obviously, as you're getting better, you're going to catch more fish. You just have more experience. You know more little tricks. And when you're first starting, it could be a little frustrating because you're not catching fish. And obviously, that's a big part of it. It's more fun to catch fish than not catch fish. But we have places like coming up here, you know, Echo Cove at the very end of the road. That place just fills up with pink salmon. There's probably a few out there now, but come July, and they're the friendliest of all the salmon in terms of taking your fly. So somebody who's brand new to fly fishing can go out there and have a really good chance of being successful. So,
now, you mentioned the word instruction. So does that mean you would teach a person how to fly fish? Do you do those kinds of lessons, or were you referring to fly tying?
Both. But in the summer, we just do fly fishing. We leave the fly tying for the dark months here when we need another hobby. But we do lessons all the time. And this summer, actually, like this Friday night, we do a free lesson. Just if people want to give it a try, they can come by the shop at 6 o'clock. We have rods and reels. We'll just do a little impromptu, this is what fly fishing is all about, for about 45 minutes. And then we go out onto the Mendenhall River on a gravel bar, and we'll cast for about an hour. And people can just see if they like it. We've been doing those, and they've been a lot of fun. We're doing another one, actually, this Saturday also from 10 to noon. So it's just a great way to give it a try and see if it's something people might want to pursue.
What is the name of your shop? If people are looking for it, will it be obvious on Old Dairy Road by Urgent Care? Why don't you tell me the name of the store, and if you have a presence on the web.
Yeah. It's Alaska Fly Fishing Goods. We have a big sign outside, so you should be able to see that. Pretty easy to find. You can see it right as you're going by on Egan Drive. And that is actually, harkens back to your earlier question, can you make a living with owning a fly fishing shop? Our website has been a huge part of what really keeps us going, because it turns out there's an awful lot of people that come to Alaska to go fly fishing. Not necessarily to Juneau, but they are going out to Bristol Bay or the Kenai, and they are looking for things online, and we're helping them find them.
So. I was on a plane to Yakutat not that long ago, and it was stuffed with men, although I know it's not exclusive to men in terms of being a pleasurable sport, but stuff with guys headed to Yakutat for fishing, and I know that some of them were fly fishers as well. So
Can you reveal where your favorite place is to fly fish? And do you have time in the summer to even get a rod out?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have to get out there. I mean, that's just part of my job. So, yeah.
Someone has to go out.
And I do. You know, the beauty of Juneau is there's so much fly fishing that's just a 10, 15, 20-minute drive away that you can sneak out for a couple hours. And if I had to pick one spot, I would pick Montana Creek out in the Mendenhall Valley. It's just a...
Where do you access Montana Creek?
There's all kinds of spots. You can go in right where it hits the Mendenhall River. Okay. You know, there's the paved bike trail that goes over it there. You could fish all the way up. I mean, it's miles up until you even hit Back Loop. And then you can just keep going up by the community garden.
And
I mean,
so it's accessible.
Yeah, and such a beautiful urban stream that really is an amazing fishery. So.
Well, Brad, it's been a pleasure talking to you and the Alaska Fly Fishing Goods Store. On Friday night at 6 o'clock, and again on Saturday from 10 to noon, we'll be offering free fly fishing lessons, and you get to step outside and put your line into the Mendenhall and see what you can bring up there. I've enjoyed our conversation. Thanks for joining us, Brad.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
All right.
Here's a story about three little fishies who didn't want to listen to their mama. In the middle, in the itty bitty pool, swam the three little fishies and a mama fishy too. Swim, said the mama fish, swim if you can. So they swam and they swam right over the dam. Down in the meadow, in the itty bitty pool, swam the three little fishies and a mama fishy too. Twim said the mama fish, swim if you can. So they swam and they swam right over the dam. Reep, beep, leop, box, wheelie, open, doobie, doobie, dip, dip, doobie, doobie, diddy, doobie. So they swam and they swam right over the dam. Stop, said the mama fish, or you will get lost. But those three little fishes didn't want to be lost. The three little fishies went out on a spree, and they swam and they swam right out to the sea. Stop, said the mama fish, or you will get lost. But the three little fishies didn't want to be lost. The three little fishies went off on a spree, and they swam and they swam right out to the sea. Pretty squeal, loop, my wooten doody, broop, bop, a lily, a boba, day, a boo, ow, fiddly, dip, bop, boo, dip, scoody, doo, doo, and they swam and they swam right out to the sea. The little fishies, here's a lot of fun. We'll swim in the sea till the day is done. So they swam and they swam, it was all a lark. Till all of a sudden, they met a big shark. We said to little fishies, here's a lot of fun. We'll swim in the sea till the day is done. They swam and they swam, it was such a lark. Till all of a sudden, they saw a big shark. Pretty pretty little.
Well, welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. Pleased to have Mary Fitzgerald and Jana Brewster from the Front Street Community Health Center here with us this afternoon. Why don't each of you describe the role that you have at the center and tell us where it is as well.
Well, I'm Jana Brewster, and I'm a nurse practitioner, and I'm the medical provider for the clinic and also the manager of the clinic. And the clinic is located in the Miners Mercantile on the second floor in Suite 202, so like we're right across from the First National Bank. So you find us up there.
Right downtown.
Yeah.
And Mary, what's your role at the center?
I am the behavioral health provider, the Front Street Clinic.
And talk a little bit about your hours, and can anybody come by, or is it specifically for a certain population is underserved? Because I recall the opening of the center, and I remember that was one of the missions, was to reach out to those who might not be getting regular care.
Absolutely. And so the clinic has been able to serve the homeless population of Juneau for over 10 years now. And it was under search that was functioning. And on May 1st, we are no longer with search. And so we have developed our own a nonprofit organization, which is the Front Street Community Health Center, which allows us to not only continue to serve the homeless, but to also reach out to the community. And so for those that are not insured or of low income or just really don't have a place to go.
A medical home.
Mm-hmm. that we are opening our doors and welcoming the community in.
Talk to me about the number of your clients. How many people would you say that you're serving on a monthly or an annual basis? Do you have that kind of data?
Well, very rough figures.
Sure.
One of the unique things about our clinic, or at least that we think is unique, is we have available behavioral health, medical, and dental services. Dental's very part-time compared. Mary and I are both full-time. But last year, we had about 2,300 patient visits for the year. The homeless populations around that we see is around 300. We believe there's about 500 homeless actually in the town of Juneau. So we have quite a few of those.
And is definition of homeless not having a permanent place for nighttime shelter?
Correct. So people who are in even transitional housing, such as St. Vincent de Paul, the Polaris House, Jamie Housing, those folks are also, we consider them homeless and eligible for services. The Halfway House, we have folks come from there to come and see us.
That sounds like a lot of work for just two people.
It is a lot of work.
It is. But it's also really rewarding work. And so we are able to work with very complex individuals. But, you know, that's the beauty of the clinic, is that we get to greet people right where they're at and have the different providers, you know, so that they do have the medical, those issues being addressed, and the behavioral health and the dental. And you'd be amazed at what that combination provides for them.
I'm guessing you use the word complex, Mary, and I'm just curious, how can you provide services to an individual who perhaps has very complex issues that have existed for a long time? Do you tackle it as an integrated team, and do you keep track of that person as they then exit the clinic and maybe go back into the community? Talk a little bit about how you approach the most complicated cases that present themselves both with social emotional issues and health issues, physical health issues.
Well, if you want to talk about how we work together on those, I mean, yes, the people that come to see us, it's funny, they don't come because they have a cold or they have the flu. Usually their diabetes is out of control, or their hypertension's not being taken care of, or they have seizure disorders that haven't been medicated for a while. And, of course, people who are living on the street or are homeless suffer from a lot of emotional strain in their life, given that maybe they lost their job, they lost their health. It's not just people that have mental illnesses that end up on the street. It's people who have lost their livelihood for some reason or another. So if they come in to see me, you know, I work very diligently to find out, you know, we tease out what their health problems are. And then, you know, if usually depression or anxiety is a concurrent problem, and that's when we get them to see Mary. And if it's a real bad day for them, Mary will come into my treatment room and help me, you know, help this person just be calm for that day.
So, Mary, typically therapy is something that occurs over time. Do you find that opportunity with the clients that you serve, that you can build that relationship and invite them back? And
absolutely.
Is that possible with a transient population or a population
absolutely.
That's not sure where it's going to be tonight?
Surprisingly so, yes. And I've been with Front Street for, well, over a year and a half now, and have been able to develop those relationships and have been able to see them open up and dare to hope again.
Now, how are you funded? You said there is a new foundation that will support the Front Street Clinic. How does the foundation raise funds? Is it through grants? Do you bill insurance? Are you having a fundraiser? Or is it all of those things? Let's talk about how to keep the foundation healthy.
Well, it's not really a foundation. We're governed by a board of directors. And I guess you call us a corporation at the moment. But we did, in order to keep Front Street open last fall, we did receive some money from community members. Maria Levishek from the Glory Hole went out and raised some money for us to help search, keep us open, and the Juneau Community Foundation did help us. And then the search for years had money for our clinic under what's called the HRSA grant, or the Health Resources Services Act granting organization. They're a federal group that gives grants to people that are taking care of the low income, the more needy populations. There's five different groups. So we were, with the development of our board of directors, we were able to, you know, put together the grant and apply for the HRSA grant so that we could have it for ourselves, which we were awarded that grant in April. And so we have that grant, and then we also received funding from the Alaska Mental Health Trust to keep us going. And then we have a small grant from the state for capital funding for new equipment and the things like that we need. So then the other part of the that pays for about maybe a third of our operations, so, or maybe, yeah, probably a third. And then, so by welcoming in other folks, you know, that have insurance and can pay privately if they don't have insurance, it'll give us the opportunity to raise, you know, some more funding so we can keep, you know, keep going with our primary focus on the homeless and the more needy people in Juneau.
So no one would be denied service, but the services are open to anybody who has insurance as well.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk again about where folks can find you, and if you have an online presence, can they learn more about what you do online?
We are not online yet. We are hoping to be there soon. Again, we're at 225 Front Street, Suite 202 in the Miners Mercantile. Our phone number is 586-4230, and anybody's welcome to call and find out about our services and, you know,
just come down and see us.
What are your hours if somebody wanted to stop by and see what you had to offer?
Well, our clinic is, we're there from 8 to 5. The clinic is open to for patients from 9 to 4. We have to have a little time before and after to for our administrative purposes.
But is that every day of the week?
5 days a week.
5 days a week.
Yes.
What do folks do who are in need on the weekend? Do they end up at the emergency room or urgent mm-hmm. care, something like that?
Yes, at this point in time, that's what would happen.
In your long-range planning to try and do a daily service that would be 24/7? You look exhausted when I say that. I'm sorry.
We're a little ways away from that yet, Lori. But, yes, we are looking forward to expanding the clinic with the hours and staff, but we're a little ways from there.
So, Mary, you've been with the clinic about a year?
Yes.
And Jana, how about you?
I'm almost 4 years.
Thank you for your service. Thank you for giving to those who sometimes can be invisible in our community mm-hmm. and who very much need what you do. We appreciate it, and thank you for being on our show today. So just to repeat, we've been visiting with Mary Fitzgerald and Jana Brewster, who are from the Front Street Community Health Center. You can find that clinic at 225 Front Street. You said that was Suite 202?
Okay.
Or you can give them a call and learn more about what's available upstairs there at 586-4230. That's Juneau Afternoon for today, Wednesday, June 25th. Don't forget, today is the deadline at close of business if you want to get your 4th of July parade entry in. Forms are available at the Mendenhall Library. Of course, that's in the Valley. And at Cycle Alaska, right downtown, the red building by the bridge. Fill one out, get it to the place where you picked it up, and attach your entry fee. Let's have a fantastic parade this year. Yes, the word clear is in the forecast. Diminishing clouds this evening. Maybe a few showers, and it'll be a little bit chilly. But by tomorrow, we're going to see a high around 66 with some light breezes, and by tomorrow, mostly clear. And Friday, a few of those clouds are coming back, but we're looking at a high at around 68. That's darn near summer weather. So a couple nice days ahead, and hopefully that will hold us through the weekend. Thanks for joining me and Jeff Brown today on Juneau Afternoon. Tomorrow on Juneau Afternoon, we have an exciting program, the Student Exchange Program. We'll hear about the Gustavus Centennial again, and Catherine Hatch will be here, as we hear every Thursday, with Arts Up. That's Juneau Afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF.